information on what you've heard? Have a travel question or comment? Just log on to petergreenberg.com. Now, here's Peter.
33 minutes after the hour, Peter Greenberg here with you from Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic. You can always reach me at peter@petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We'll solve it right here on the air. In fact, let's do that right now. Here's one from Aaron and Michael Brand, who write, "My husband and I are taking a long trip around South America. We are both U.S. citizens, and we're wondering if there are any countries that require us to get a visa before visiting. We plan to stay down there for about a year. In addition to that, how do we extend our normal 90-day stay if we decide we want to stick around someplace longer than originally anticipated?" Okay, well, there's a two-parter to this question, which means you're going to get a two-parter answer. First of all, let's talk about visas. If you look at all the countries in South America, the one that you're going to absolutely need a visa for is Brazil. And the good news is you can get a multiple entry five-year visa. That's what you want. You have to watch out for countries like Argentina that have a reciprocity problem where they might charge you about $132 to enter, because we charge Argentinians $132 to enter the U.S., but not there's a visa problem there. Chile, you don't need a visa. You don't need a visa to Ecuador. You don't need a visa to most of the other countries there. Chances are you're not going to Paraguay. Bolivia is going to be fine. Peru is going to be fine. So the one you got to get a visa for sure is Brazil. Now, there's a second part to your question, and that's where it gets a little tricky. When you get a visa, you're going to be given a visa, if you ask for it ahead of time, for multiple entry. So you're still going to have that 90-day rule, but that means you can go out of the country for a day and come back the next day and stay for another 90 days. Understand? So it's just a matter of just leaving town, and that, you know, you could cross a border for a day. It's no big deal. So that's how you extend the trip. It's really as simple as that. Okay, so you go. That's easy. Here's one from Lily C., who writes, "Do you have any idea how Brexit, now that it has happened, will affect American tourists to the UK, particularly those who might want to move to the UK?" Well, this is a brave new world of bilateral agreements that all have to be renegotiated once Brexit happens. Remember, all the airline deals, all the monetary deals, all the current exchange deals, all the trade deals that were negotiated as a group with the European Union now fall apart, at least to the UK, if you want to deal with Great Britain, because if they leave the European Union, those deals don't apply anymore. That even includes airline rights. You know, can British Airways still fly X number of flights a week to the United States under a bilateral agreement that they're no longer a part of? This is going to get a little crazy, because it really means, if everybody believes the letter of the law, that every one of those original agreements that was signed with the EU has to now be individually renegotiated agreement by agreement. Wow. Talk about slow walking. It's going to be tough. Now, you asked about moving to the UK. Won't be a problem. It won't be a problem. Unless, of course, you want to get work there. And that's existed before the Brexit issue. So you have to check with the British consulate in New York or the British consulate in Chicago or the British consulate in LA to find out what the rules are to move to the UK if you want to earn money there. It gets a little tricky. It's not impossible, but you have to play by the rules. But here's the good news for everybody else. What's happened because of Brexit has resulted in a stagnation of the foreign visitor numbers to the United States. In fact, international travel is sort of struggling in those numbers heading westbound, meaning from Europe, from South America, coming up from the South, from the UK. Add to that the power of the US dollar, add to that the confusion or concern that happens every 4 years during an American election year, and the result is there are fewer foreigners coming to the U.S. What that means is, for everybody else, whether you're moving to the U.K. or not, like Lily and her husband, is it's a buyer's market on airfare. It is now, believe it or not, cheaper to go to Europe than it can be to go between New York and Boston. As I'm speaking to you right now, Emirates has an airfare from New York to Milan for $440 round trip. On Emirates, you cannot beat that deal. That's just one of a number of deals that are out there, not because it happens to be January, which usually is a tough quarter for the airlines, but because it's been going on for quite some time and will extend at least through the end of May. So as long as you're not planning on getting a suntan in Paris in February, go. You're not going to be disappointed. And that's going to keep going as long as I can imagine. And that is a definite side effect or a byproduct, if you will, of the confusion surrounding Brexit. And that will continue with us well into the year 2020, which is where we are right now. So the answer to your question is, you can go. You should go. Just work out the deal of the other, you know, sort of intangible of what are the UK requirements if you want to get a job there. Remember, foreign countries are relatively protectionist in this regard. They don't want you taking the job of someone else who's a citizen there who can do similar work. So you have to come up with a job category that no one else can do, that you are uniquely qualified to do, which is, by the way, what we do in the United States for people coming to do work here or going to Canada and doing work there. So as long as you understand that distinction, you should have no trouble going. Here's an email from Trisha Cott, who writes, we've paid unknown resort fees many times at Marriott and Sheraton resorts. What can we do? Well, I know you're basically relating to the current lawsuits filed in both the District of Columbia and in Nebraska against both Marriott and Hilton, claiming, among other things, failure to disclose on a number of things on their websites, including those draconian resort fees. Those cases are still going through the process. Nothing's been resolved yet. But if you're asking what you can do about the fees you paid in the past, you're going to have to wait for the resolution in these cases, because they may do retroactive paybacks, as they do in many of these class action cases, when people fail to disclose. However, moving forward, it's very easy for you to figure out what to do. And that is, when you reserve online or with a travel agent, if it is not fully disclosed to you at the time of the reservation that you'll be paying a resort fee and the amount of that fee and also what it covers, or it's not disclosed to you when you check in and sign your registration form, then you have rights, because you received a service you didn't contract for. And you can dispute that on your credit card. But before you have to dispute it on your credit card, you have to be even more responsible and aware. And that is this. And most people don't do this. And by the way, I'm sometimes one of them. And that is, most of us, when we check out of the hotel, we just, you know, we've already given them our credit card and we race out because we're probably late to the airport. And it's only when we get home, it's sticker shock time when we get the bill from our credit card company and we see that charge on the bill. That's the point where you have to dispute the charge. But you can preempt that by going to the front desk on the night before you check out and just asking them for a printout of your bill. And if there's a resort fee on there, which you did not receive notification of when you either made your reservation or when you checked in, you can negotiate that at that point. And if they refuse to take it off at that point, become a good reporter, get their first name and last name, their title, and email me, and I'll take it from there. Because I'm not an attorney general, nor do I play one on TV, but I do understand the laws about failure to disclose, and we will get that taken care of. Now, if they do disclose it, guess what? You're stuck with it. Resort fees are an insult. They're an opportunity for a hotel or a resort to try to be competitive officially on rate, but they're not being competitive on value. And I just wish there'd be more transparency in the hotel industry, and basically just, let's be honest, folks. Let's just tell people what their room costs and not expect them to go to page 5 of the website, because none of us do, including me, ever go to page 5 on the website to find out there are additional costs. It's just not nice. So stand by for the resolution of those two cases, and keep in mind that there are 36 attorneys general in other states that are contemplating additional legal action along the exact same lines as the Attorney General of Nebraska and the District of Columbia. Here's one from Corey Steinberg, who writes, quick question about U.S. immigration. If you aren't traveling to the U.S. or from the U.S., but just have a stopover in Puerto Rico, do you have to go through U.S. Customs? Well, that's a little bit of a tricky question there, because if you're flying into Puerto Rico not from the U.S., and you're flying from like the British Virgin Islands, of course you have to go through U.S. Customs. You're coming from a foreign country. If you're flying to Puerto Rico from St. Thomas, you don't. Get it? St. Thomas is a U.S. protectorate, just like Puerto Rico is. So it's a territory. So that's it. Puerto Rico is an extension of the United States as it pertains to people flying in from foreign countries. Therefore, you have to go through U.S. Customs. Now, here's an interesting one from Amanda R., and she writes, does the TSA have size restrictions when it comes to screening bags for security? Well, the answer is not officially, but practically they do, because the actual conveyor belt machinery that they use is basically the same size. So all you have to do when you're not looking, or when the TSA officers aren't looking, is get out a tape measure and figure out what those dimensions are and realize that if your bag can't fit in that conveyor belt, it ain't going through security. And if it's not going through security, it's not getting to the plane. Of course, the real challenge for most travelers who try to beat the airlines at their own game playing by their rules is to find a bag big enough that will fit in that conveyor belt that they can take to the gate. And of course, when they get to the gate, the airline will then say to them, either A, they'll look the other way and let them bring it on the plane, or they'll say, that's too big to check it to carry it on. We'll have to check it for you at no charge. Everybody plays that game. I was at a jetway at Delta Airlines at Kennedy one day on a U.S. domestic flight and counted 53 bags on the jetway that had to be checked because people were able to sneak them through security and not pay the $25 or $35 checked bag fees. And since we're in a new year, let me give you a little bit of bad news. Last year, the airlines made more money in sheer profit from checked baggage fees than they made operating as airlines. So that, you know, that brings me to the conclusion that the airlines aren't really in the travel and transportation business. They're in the human and non-human cargo business. So think about that. But if you want to beat them at their own game and get the bag checked, hopefully at no cost at the gate, just measure the dimensions of the conveyor belt the next time you go to the airport. Or just ask the TSA guy there. They really don't vary much in size, right? Here's one from Amelia Penn who writes, what's the difference between a converter and an adapter? Amelia, I found that out the hard way early on in my travel career when I plugged a hairdryer into an adapter and blew it up. Because an adapter only means it allows you to take a U.S. plug into the adapter, which then plugs into a European or Australian or, you know, different plug in their system. But it's about the voltage and the amps. And you need a converter if you're going to use a high voltage a high voltage machine because it's got to step down the voltage. It's got to step it down so it doesn't blow the fuse. And once it blows a fuse, it doesn't blow a fuse in the room. It blows a fuse on the item, like the hairdryer, and it's, you know, you are done. So when you check, and by the way, in the old days, the converters were very heavy. They weighed about 20 pounds, something you don't need to pack. So when you're going to a hotel overseas, don't ask them if they just have an adapter plug. You may need that anyway, but you need a converter which plugs into, which you plug into the converter, and then that plugs in to the electrical socket in the country or location where you are. All right, adapter is fine if you're doing a cell phone. Adapter is fine if you're doing a computer. Adapter is fine if you're doing, you know, just a basic electronic item. But anything heavy duty, and I'm not talking about, you know, chainsaws, but a heater or a hair dryer or a microwave, anything that's going to take some juice, you need that converter or it's going to blow up. So now you know, just ask the hotel and they have them, they'll send them to the room. Now you know the difference. And the bottom line is you don't have to buy it. You can borrow it. Here's one from Arthur Hampton who writes, do I need a visa to go to Canada? I want to visit my cousin in Toronto. Well, Arthur, as long as you live in the United States, you don't need a visa unless you're going to work in Canada. If you're going there as a tourist, you essentially get a visa on arrival. The Canadians make it very easy to do it even electronically on kiosks now when you land in any of their international gateway airports. So there should be no problem at all. Just make sure that when you fill out the form, you're not there on business. You're there to see your cousin. You're there to see a relative. You're there on vacation. And then the best part of the deal, and we got to, you know, hats off to the Canadians because they've been doing it since 1952. They were the first guys to do it. It's pre-clearance on the way home. And that is, you clear U.S. Customs and Immigration in Canada at the airport right there in Toronto so that when you get off your flight back in the U.S., you're not going through customs.
Your bags aren't going through customs. They've already been through customs. You just get your bags and go home. Or if you have no bags, you just go home. So there you go. No visa needed if you're not going there to work. And on the way home, it's pre-clearance, which we have in a number of countries. It's the Bahamas has it. Ireland has it. Abu Dhabi has it. We need more countries to do it, but it really works like a charm. Here's one from Sharon Bailey who writes, and I love this one. I was going through security the other day, and the lady in front of me's thin sweater got me thinking. What if that thin sweater jacket is all she's wearing with nothing underneath? Would the TSA have her get a pat-down instead, or would she enter the scan machine like everyone else? Well, let's get back to the rules. Unless you have, special dispensation, either handicapped or pre-check, if you're wearing a sweater, you can go through. If you're wearing a heavy garment over that, a jacket, a parka, that has to be taken off and go through the machine. If you're not wearing anything under the sweater, and it's a heavy sweater, the TSA may, in fact, ask you for secondary screening. And if that's the case, then a female TSA agent will do the pat-down. It's as simple and as silly and somewhat, invasive as that. But if it's a very light sweater and it's essentially the first outer garment that they see and there's no reason to suspect anything else, then you should be able to go through. But remember, if it's a heavy sweater, they want it off. And if it's the only thing she's wearing, it's going to be pat-down time. Here's another one that always comes into play for international travelers. Adam Agadu writes, is it possible to use an airline lounge after a flight too? I'll be flying into LAX, but my sister won't be able to pick me up for at least 2 hours after I land, so it would be nice if I could go and have a drink there while I wait. Not sure what the lounge rules are at the airports. Well, assuming you're not coming in on an international flight, you'll be walking right by the lounge when you get off your plane. Every airline has its own rule as to who gets to use the lounge. Many lounges insist that you can only use a lounge if you're carrying a boarding pass for a same-day flight and for the flight that's going to a destination, not coming from one. American Express, actually, for their Centurion clubs, lists an hour limitation on how long you can spend in the club no matter what you're doing. So it's really done by an airline-by-airline, case-by-case basis. Don't forget to email me to peter@petergreenberg.com with your questions, and we'll answer them right here on the air. Coming up, jewelry maker, American expat Ashley Dubinsky on how she came and stayed in the Dominican Republic.
Please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened. Eye on Travel. We'll be right back.